Okay, so welcome back, everybody. We are in Making the Mikdash Part 2, and I want to describe the unique challenge that we have ahead of us and why this makes it actually very exciting. The challenge that we have is that we're learning about a base of Mikdash, which we have very little visual evidence of. Why? For two reasons. Reason number one is that whenever we think about the tabernacle, we have images of one of two things. If we're thinking Mishkan, we're thinking back to the times of Moshe Rabbeinu. So we've learned and we spent in day school a whole lot of time in Parashas Truma, Tetzaveh, Vayakhel, and Pekudei, and therefore a lot of those images remain in our minds when we think about the tabernacle or the place of resting of Hashem. The other place that we think about when we think, oh, Mikdash, is we have images of the second base of Mikdash, the Herodian Temple. And part of the reason is because it was more recent, we have more archaeological evidence, and then we also have more pictures. The average picture, if you type into Google Images, Beis HaMikdash, you are looking at a picture of the second Beis HaMikdash. So generally speaking, that's generally what we're going to be looking at. So our struggle is to be focusing on this Beis HaMikdash, not getting it confused and conflated with the Mishkan, and not confusing it with the Herodian Beis HaMikdash, which is essentially the third Beis HaMikdash, really. Even though we call it the second Beis HaMikdash, there were two iterations of it. When Herod caused a terrible amount of destruction among the Jews, what his response was, his tshuva process was to give a facelift to the second Beis HaMikdash, and it made it really beautiful. The Gemara says that a person didn't see the Beis HaMikdash, referring to Herod's version of the Beis HaMikdash, never saw a beautiful building in their day. So it really was beautiful, but it's not what we're learning about. So that is our struggle, is to try to be able to give a sense, a creation, and a picture of something which we really have very little to see of in today's day and age. There are a number of pictures which we will see, and we're going to try to focus on trying to recreate this image. And then one of the questions which should be scratching at the back of our minds the entire time that we're learning this is, now what did Shlomo have in front of him? What did he have in front of him? Did he have blueprints? Because all he knew up till now was Mishkan and permanent Mishkan. Remember, the Mishkan changed its form when it entered the land of Israel. It was no longer the beams and the rafters. Why? Because it didn't need to be. It could be more permanent. So when it came to Shiloh, it was actually made of stone. The curtains were over the stone creation. So what was Shlomo looking at that he was creating? What in divine inspiration was he getting as he was creating this Beis HaMikdash? These are the questions that we have to ask ourselves. And therefore, part of the questions are going to also frame it, fall around. So what was he changing and why? How similar or how dissimilar is this to the Mishkan? And why would he be doing these kind of things? In any contrast that we have, would you see the roots for this? Where was it rooted? Why was he doing this? Why was he changing it? These are the questions that we ought to be thinking about as we learn about this. So we learned last week about an alliance between Tyre and Jerusalem, where essentially a lot of the supplies, certainly the cedars, the wood, was coming from the north, and that is where we left off. There is one section in between which just describes the tax, and we're not going to spend so much time on this. I just want to, for the sake of posterity, let's just quickly close Perek Hay. This runs from Psukim, Perek Hay. If you have the actual text of Tanakh, it runs from Psukim Chof Vov to Lamed Beis. This really concludes the tax of Shlomo and how the Beis Nedrash was built. This is not our focus on tonight. Our focus tonight is the very beginning of Perek Vov. That's where it really starts. But let's take a quick look at this. Vashem nosan chochmo li Shlomo kasher diber loy. Hashem gives wisdom to Shlomo. There's an alliance between Tyre, the Phoenicia and Israel together, and there's peace between them. They cut a bilateral covenant. So Shlomo levies a tax, but the tax is not a tax of money or food, it's a tax of service. Right, so to speak, we're in America in the 1930s, Lahavdil, right? So there's mandated work that people need to be, and that's 30,000 men. Vayishlochem is the end of Perakei. Vayin Pasuk Chavches now. Vayishlochem lavononon. Aser salafim b'chodesh chalifois, chodesh yiye balavonon. Shtaim chodoshim b'veisoi, vadiniram alamas. And so there'd be this rotation. 10,000 men at a time would be on. Then there'll be two months off. So it'd be very hard labor for 1 month, 2 months off. And the tax was essentially bringing the supplies necessary under this peace accord to Israel. Vayhi lishlomo shivim elef noisei sabal shmonim elef chotzev bahar. So now, in addition to this, there was also these people who would now, how do they translate it in our translations here? I only have the Hebrew version in front of me. What is the way they technically translate it here? Is that they would, and these are the people who would, the bearers of the burden, they call it, which, and they would, 80,000 were sent to the quarries in the mountains. So now, for those of you who ever played Settlers of Catan, right? This is our initiation, right? You can't build anything with one particular natural resource. You need to have wood, and you need to have rock. You need to have stones. You need to have wool, right? So you need to have all the different elements. So yes, he is getting his supplies of wood from Lebanon, but he needs to get his stone from the quarry. So he sends an 80,000 task force out up to the mountains. Levad misorei hanisavim nishlama asher alam lacha. And then there was a team of these are the overseers, it sounds like, who are in charge of the teams. Fine, that's how it was set up. So they cut out these very large stones to be the foundation of Solomon's temple. And this is the end of, and the Givolites apparently would help them fashion and build the house. Fantastic. This is the back end. Not going to spend so much time focusing on this. There is one interesting thing to think about over here is these stones, these foundation stones, where were they coming from and how were they carving them? That will relate to what we get to soon. So this is Ad Kan. Is previous week. This is the alliance of Tyre, Jerusalem. This is the tax, and people are all working together. Now we get into our section. There's one pasuk which we're about to read, which is the beginning of Perek Vav, and this pasuk itself is a very, very difficult pasuk to understand. It's such an important pasuk to dating everything, but it's very difficult to understand. Here we go. Here is what it says. This is the beginning of today. Vayhi b'shnuanim shana. It was at 480 years after the nation of Israel left Egypt. It was in the fourth year of what's fourth year of what? From where? Fourth year of Shlomo's rule. Good. So we count from the king's rule. So it's fourth year of his kingship. In the Chodesh of Ziv, I believe this is either Iyar or Cheshvan. I always forget if it's the one after. If it's the one after Chodesh Hasheni, LeMelech Shlomo al Yisrael vayiven habayis laHashem, and he builds a house to Hashem. So now, what's curious about this pasuk? Just before we go further, like what should we be asking when we look at this?
Why does it make a difference how many years from when we left Egypt?
Yeah, I mean, like since when was Egypt the time marker for anything? Like, we haven't been talking about Yetzias Mitzrayim at all. We've been through all of Sefer Yoshua, Shoftim, Shmuel Aleph, Shmuel Beis, now we're in Melachim. Why suddenly now are we thinking about Yetzias Mitzrayim? Maybe it's such a monumentous, milestone. So therefore, Tanakh is emphasizing when it starts from. But it seems a little strange that suddenly out of the blue, now Yetzias Mitzrayim is now placed as our time marker. Seems like a very strange kind of dating. I understand the dating of the king's rule, right? So we understand that's the fourth year of his kingship. We have to question that as well. Because, you know, why did he wait so long then? You know, like, so why was it 4 years in? But independent of that, why do we need Yetzias Mitzrayim here? What do you think?
All the promises that Hashem gave to the Jewish people when they're going to enter the land of Israel.
Interesting.
This is the first time this really, it's coming to
fruition. So wait a second. Don't, let's just be clear. A lot of the promises that were made to Israel about entering the land were promises of plenty and settlement and conquest. But the idea of building a base of Mikdash, right, that wasn't talked about until the times later on, meaning there is the notion, there's a veiled reference of Leshichno Sidrashu Vasasham, there's going to be a place that I'll reside. But for a good 369 years, that was the Mishkan in Shiloh, right? So we had that place, so to speak. So, yes, we'll call contentment, fulfillment, harmony, these we've seen, but that's not the dating process here. The dating process is to the building of the Beis HaMikdash. Just seems an odd time mark. It's very helpful, by the way, because this helps us frame, working backwards, we can now frame the whole experience. We know when Yetzias Mitzrayim was, and now we know how many days they were in the desert, and we know how long Yehoshua lived, so now we can sort of work out, and this is the reference point from which all the Mepharshim try to work out, how long did Shoftim last? How long did Shmuel's life last? How long was the reign of Shaul? How long was the reign of David? This is the time marker that is the reference point. So it's a very helpful passage, but why do we need it so much? So we're going to spend a little bit of time tonight looking into... No?
Did he start to build it in that time?
Yes, that sounds...
He started to build it, so it took those amount of time, I think, for these thousands of people when you go to a quarry and do stone.
So it takes time.
So it takes years to get there.
So you're right. So the 4 years into his kingship, maybe that's the point. Maybe it took 4 years just for him to get simply enough resources to have the stockpile necessary to make it. So, but then we refer, and the building permits, right? In Israel, it's very difficult, right? Yeah. So now that is, by the way, this is also something we should be aware of. This is the first time in Jewish history that they don't need to build the building permit from somebody else. That's exactly the point. Nobody else, nobody's overseeing. Unlike later on when they build the second Beis HaMikdash, where there is an overseer, you have to get a building permit from Persia. This is the first time in Jewish history we can say we want to build what we want to build, and nobody's gonna say anything else. That is a pretty remarkable moment. But nonetheless, so Nachman's addressing the question of the 4 years, but really the 480 years, why is this so necessary? So the Arbar Banel, we're going to do a little bit of Arbar Banel this evening because, first of all, just every time one learns the Arbar Banel, it just opens vistas into our perspective. But nonetheless, also tonight, he hones in on a few very fascinating points. Esther.
I'm thinking maybe it's not the time frame. Maybe it's more showing the building, that they were, what they were building in the triumph versus what they're building now.
Interesting. So maybe to say, this is not so much about time as it is about stages of development. So stage development number one was the Yetzias Mitzrayim, and then stage development number two was the building of the Beis HaMikdash. But then what is the ideological connection between those two steps?
The Jews built the pyramids, now they're going to build the
pyramids. Right, they say that the pyramids is the ultimate Jewish building, right? Because you can imagine, Chaimi and Chaim were working on this building, and they say, they don't really need it that every row is the same. We could just shift it in a little bit, nobody will notice, right? And the next row they did the same thing. And hence we have Giza, right? No, but nonetheless. So there is another building. So I actually would like to hone in on exactly that point. Here's what Abba Benel says. Abba Benel says the time marker is specific to this moment. Here's what he says in Source 14. This is now actually in the actual handouts for today, Unit 3.2, the uniqueness of the sanctuary. He says, "Uhu haya soid eloki komus imoy yisparach." There was a hidden. There is a hidden secret which is unfolding right in front of our eyes today, which is hidden in his chambers. And the prophet, who is Yirmiyahu at this point, who's actually the narrator of Melachim, is telling it to us. So what's the first time marker? It's not so much about Exodus as it is about the tabernacle. So version one of making God a space in this world was 480 years ago. Version two was when Shlomo modified it and now made the Beis HaMikdash. Umisham gam kein ad shmonim shana v'arba me'al shana acheros nivne beis ha'lokim pam acheres al yedei Zerubbabel. And he points out that if you read, and we're not going to learn the whole Arbar Banel inside right now, but he says if you go to Seder Olam Rabba, which is the Medrash, which gives us the time frame of all of Jewish history, this is what Rashi uses all the time when giving us the dates throughout the Tanakh, the Seder Olam. If you go into the Seder Olam, you'll note that there's a 480-year gap between Binyan Shlomo and Binyan Zerubbabel, which is the second Beis HaMikdash. Which means, if you think about it, that therefore we have a pattern. We have version A, version B, and version C, all equidistant, all spaced in the same time frame. Fascinating. What's the meaning of this? He says an interesting thing, the following. Let's just skip down. I apologize, I did not give line numbers. Oh, I'm over here. He says the following. It's the last word of the line is actually Sheh HaBayis. It's about two-thirds of the way down. There's a little period that says, Ukumoi Sheh HaBayis, Asher Bono Shlomo, Mitzad HaPoel, רוצה לומר, מצד קדושת הבית ומצד שלמות שלמה, שהיבונה והפועלוסוי היו למטה בקדושה ובאלוקוס, לאין שיעור מהמשכן אשר עשה מוישה, מפס קדושתו ומקדושת מוישה רבנו עליו השלום. שלמה המלך, both in terms of his being and in terms of the building he was making, was incrementally lower. Right? He was not the prophet, the king of all prophets like Moses. And his building was not specifically dictated word for word and brick for brick by Hashem. Kacha ba'osa erech hoya binyan ba'es sheni v'zerubavel abone osa ilamata b'kedusha v'dveikus v'ruach ha'kodesh ma'binyan asher osa shlomo. So we see the same sequential step down, in the sense, by the next step, which is 480 years later, which is when Zerubbabel is doing it. Less divine inspiration, less divinely inspired leaders, more human involvement. Which is, in a certain sense, we're witnessing a certain progression in history towards perhaps lower Kedusha, but what fills the space of lower Kedusha? What fills that void?
The temple, but
each of them are a temple, but what is filling the void? Now Hashem's doing less, so we have the human creativity is filling that void. So there's a progression, says Abarbanel, between godly dictation and human creativity. And that human creativity is finding itself more and more as history goes on, which is the pattern that we see in this movement of Mishkan, Mikdash Rishon, Mikdash Sheni. Which leaves us an interesting question, which Abarbanel does not address here. Then what can we expect going forward? There's a fascinating debate as to how divine the Bais Shlishi, the third Bais HaMikdash, will be. Is it going to be completely coming out of heaven in fire, like Rashi says? Or will it be built brick by brick by human beings, which is the way the Rambam paskins? And this ideology is sort of reflecting this interesting pattern that Abarbanel is saying. You know, there's a place in Yerushalayim, which I'm sure many people have visited, which is called Machon HaMikdash. Machon HaMikdash is building up all the different parts of the Kelim of the Beis HaMikdash, and they have maps, and it's very fascinating, as they believe that the whole process of building the Beis HaMikdash will, in fact, be very much human-led, at least in terms of the Kelim, or sort of the outer aspects of it. So this follows, this interesting pattern is, how much space is there for the humans, and how much does HaKadosh Baruch Hu have a space in it? Fascinating pattern that we see emerging, and this emerges from this 480 years. Now, coming back to the other question. So, we have another time marker, which is 4 years into his rule. So you'd say, well, why so long? So the basic answer would be of course, it takes a long time to hew rock, to chop wood, to amass, and then the building permits, right, to get around the bureaucracy and red tape, to get things going. And you say, actually, that's a pretty relatively short span of time for this. Then, if that's the case, here's the problem: is that he already had the material. So, meaning, like, if we're reading Melachim, you're like, okay, well, he needs to do all the collection. But that's not the only story. We need to read the parallel story to know what's actually going on. Where is the parallel story told to us? In Devarei Hayamim, in Chronicles, in Perek Chof Beis, in Devarei Hayamim, we are told what is going on over here. Let's fast forward here. So this is in the next source, in source 15. Here is what happens. This is the missing part of the story, which we don't have here, which now should fill out our perspective. Here's what he says. Vayomer David el Shlomo, Beni, Na'ar Varach, V'abayis livnois la'ashem, la'agdil, l'mala, l'shem lo tiferes, l'kol ha'ratzos, l'chino lo'loi, v'yochin David lo'roiv lifnei mo'soi. So David knew that Shlomo was going to be the one to build the Beis HaMikdash. So what did he say? Look, he's a young boy. The Seder Olam says that he was 12 years old. Right? So in order to make it easier for him, what am I going to do? I'm going to get everything he needs. Remember, David HaMelech so badly wanted to make the Beis HaMikdash. So he did everything he possibly could, short of actually laying the bricks. He gives him the verdict to make the Beis. David Lishlomo, Beni, I wanted to build this house. Hashem said to me, you spilled too much blood. You made many wars. You poured too much blood in front of me. By the way, is that a bad thing? Is that a good thing? Worthwhile thinking about. We'll get to that debate later on. You're going to have a child. He'll be a man of peace. Right? That's what's Shlomo's name. Shalom, peace. He's going to be this man of serenity. Ki Shlomo yeh shemoi v'shalom v'sheket etein al Yisrael v'yamav. He'll build his house. He'll be my son. Now he goes on to describe all of this, and then in Pasuk Yudalad he says the following: He's already prepared for you. I have talents of gold, I have talents of silver, I have talents of bronze, I have stone, I have wood, everything you need. Now he does say, by the way, Alehem Tosif, you will add to them. But it sounds like David Melech at this point in time has already amassed them. And I have prepared for you the artisans. So not only do you have the material, you also have the people who are going to, you have the workforce necessary to be able to do this. So what in the world is it taking Shlomo HaMelech 4 years to do then?
This is in conflict with art.
With
Malachim.
It seems like it.
Where he was negotiating with
He's negotiating this whole business with Hiram. So what's going on? That's the question. So says that Abarbanel. That precisely explains the four-year gap. Shlomo HaMelech made a decision at this point in time that he wanted the house to be built with the materials that he as a king produced, procured. He did not want to rely on David's materials. Therefore, he started almost as if, now yes, he did have David's peace. David HaMelech produced peace for him necessary to be able to build a bais. But when it came to actually materials, he amassed his own materials, trade and from actual work. And the question I want to leave on the table for tonight, because this is a very important question, is why? Why did Shlomo need to, so to speak, assert himself? Why did Shlomo HaMelech need to create his own space independent of what his father had done? David HaMelech had laid the table for him. But somehow we see over here there seems to be a tension between what his father was doing and what he wanted to be able to prepare. That's something you see in here. And that explains the gap of 4 years, says Abarbanel. Why? Why is that so important to Shlomo? We see that Shlomo HaMelech, in a certain sense, Atonah has been doing everything his father had said. He has removed the enemies. He has all the behest of his father. This is the last one. This is the last request that David HaMelech made of him. And in this, he seems to be adjusting a little bit. There seems to be his own space. This is the argument of the Abarbanel. Fascinating. This is always a tension in general. You can imagine, we discussed this before, is when you have a new leader coming into town, how much do they preserve and how much do they create? It's a tension. If there's too much creation, then it's too abrupt. If there's too much conservation, then why do we need a new leader, right? This is the tension that Shlomo himself is facing, and we see a little bit of personal creativity or personal we'll call it aspirations, seem to be asserted over here in this gap. Yeah, Richard.
But if he had the material already, when this binding everything.
Yes, so what did you do with David's material? That's part of the question. What did you do with that?
The material is, I think, goes back to all the bloodshed. Maybe he didn't want material that was blood money.
Fascinating. Fascinating. So maybe one of our arguments could be is that it was related too much even to David's career. That is a very fascinating suggestion. I want to leave this question still open because I want us to give a little bit of time to think on. These are very fascinating suggestions as to why over here Shlomo is doing something a little different to what David requested of him directly, even though he gave him the keys to that storehouse. Let's move into the actual Beis Hamikdash itself. Let's take a quick look at some of the things we're about to see in this Beis Hamikdash. So the section that we're going to look through is a very short section, but let's try to get there's some very interesting and intriguing details here. By the way, this Beis Hamikdash, we're going to have a lot to look at. We're going to look at lots of different pieces of this Beis Hamikdash. So we're going to have to take it in piecemeal because there's a lot of details. We're going to try to get the overall perspective. Here's the starting point. We're looking at Sukkim Beis onwards for just a moment. So we're going to stop right now at Pasuk Zayin. So we're only doing these interleading six Sukkim. V'abayis asher bono ha-melech Shlomo la-Hashem. So here's the dimensions. It was 60 cubits high, 60 cubits in length, 20 cubits in width, and 30 high. We're going to have to see this. We don't have time to do it right now, but we should contrast this to other descriptions of it and to see that there are different pieces of this Beis Hamikdash. There's three separate chambers. There's the Kodesh HaKadoshim, the Kodesh, and the antechamber, which is the Heichal. We'll get to the Ulam, which is we're going to deal with. ואולם על פני ההיכל הבית, 20 אמה ארכוי, על פני רוחב הבית, 10 אמה רוחבוי, על פני הבית, so it has this antechamber in front of it. ויעש לבית חלוני שקופים עצומים. He made these windows broad within and narrow without. ויבן על קיר הבית יציע, and against the walls he had a side, this is a side structure or an inner chamber. אס קירוס לבית סביב להיכל ולדביר, ויעש צלעוס סביב. So the walls are actually made with chambers in the walls. So it's not simply a wall made of stones. In each wall, it's actually there's a hollow, and there are rooms within the walls themselves. Hayotzia tachtona chamesh bama rochba vatichuach sheish bama rochba vashlishis sheva bama rochma, and they are each one widening as you go down. Ki migrois nasan labayis aviv chutzah levilti achoz bikirois habayis. And we have these jutting out areas around the sides of the walls. They're built of these pure stones, quarried pure stones. And there was no axe or iron tools heard in the house while it was being built. So this is where we'll stop for a moment. Over here, there's a number of things to consider in this. We're not going to consider the dimensions for a second yet. The focus tonight is two questions. Question number one is these windows. Question number two is the stones. Okay, so number one is these windows are very interesting. You see, there's the way it's described is with words which are almost oxymoronic. The word shakuf means what's that? Lashkif. It's to see, right? Lashkif, ani mashkif, right? Hashkafa is to see. What's atum? Atum means closed or opaque, so they're transparent, opaque windows. It sounds like this is a sort of interesting description of what these windows are. Famously, the Gemara Menachos says something which I'm sure we're all aware of, which says the following. Let's take a look at the in our sources at source 17. The Gemara says, "Vayas lebayis chalane shekufim atumim, tano shekufim mibifnim vaatonim vaatumim mibachutz," that they were in fact. The way it is understood over here is that they were narrow within and broad without. So I actually put an interesting, there's just a diagram below, you can see the sort of a archaeological description or version of it, where it, so to speak, opens outwards. And if you look at the artistic version of this, this is the Binyan Shlomo, you'll notice that each window, can you see there's a, in terms of it slides open, it's wider on the outside. So why? The Gemara concludes, Loi l'oira anitzarech, because it is not, these windows were not in order to provide illumination inwardly. This is not that the bias had a light deficiency, and therefore, in a certain sense, it was there was an inner light, so to speak, in the Beis HaMikdash, not needing the light outside. What's the logic of this for a moment? Let's just think about the way the Gemara is understanding it.
God wanted the light to go out from the...
As opposed to in, right? So if you're thinking about it, to sort of speak, the light, the direction of the light, the expansion of the light seems to be moving outwards rather than the expansion of the light moving inwards. The only problem is that just architecturally, the Ralbag questions this premise, and he says, yeah...
But doesn't it say the opposite in the... It says the opposite... I mean, I was always taught it was narrow in and wide out, so the light could go out, but the text says the opposite.
Oh, so the text you're referring to is the JPS 1917 translation. Okay, so just that's the version that we're looking at right now. So the JPS, as any translation is, it's also an interpretation. You will notice that in the actual Hebrew text, it does not tell you what's where. It just says, Shekufim Atumim. They are, in translating it, incorporating into that a interpretation, which is the opposite of the Gemara. Why do they do that? So says the Ralbag. This is precisely what the Ralbag's point is. He disagrees with this vehemently. He says in Source 18, remember the Ralbag was a great astronomer. The Ralbag was a great inventor. He was a physicist and a mathematician. He was a person who invented what's called Jacob's staff, which was the precursor to the sextant. Right, so an astronomical tool for measuring distance. He was a well-revered philosopher in the world, the secular world around him. So he says the following. He says, "Wait a second." In the next source, he says, "Vayas in source 18, Vayas the bias, Haladesha Kufumatumim, Pirushu Razal, our rabbis taught, Shayura Chavimi Bachutz, they were wide on the outside, but Sarimi Bifnim, Lorois Shaeno Tsarich, Loera, that you don't need the light. Elo, Kized Derech Drash, this must be homiletic, not in literal. Kikvaris Barba Mofsim Handasayim, because you see through experimentation, what's the word Handasayim? Engineering, basic engineering, one can see. If you have a white on the outside, it increases light on the inside. Yes, we sort of think of the light going outwards. That makes sense. But actually, this allows more light in. There's more now. Instead of, if you imagine, a thick wall, right? And let's say that there's no slope in the window. It's just an opening. So I only have so much space for the light to come in. If I now shave off the corners, what's happening? I'm allowing more space for the light to actually enter. So the Ralbag says, this would actually provide more light. Okay, that's actually the next point. What's fascinating about that, so you can see, I would imagine what the Mechon Mamre, the JPS 1917 translation is doing, is flipping it to incorporate to reflect this, perhaps. Nonetheless, this is what the Ralbag says. So he questions this as this being in literal interpretation. He says no. In fact, this was actually would be a natural. This would be the natural way one would do it. If one were to want to say it was counterintuitive, it was that the light was the inside, it should be the other way around. The Ababanel says no. The Ababanel says, look, we have two concepts in tension. One is that there are windows you see through, and the other one is that there are windows you don't see through. They're shakuf and they're atum. So how do you work the two together? So Ababan has a few very fascinating creative suggestions. One, he says, it might be that we're talking about frosted glass. Right? So what does frosted glass provide you? It's like, you know, what does it do? Is it provides a whole lot of light, but it doesn't provide, you know, transparency in the way that everybody's just looking through. Right? Nobody's peering in the same way. So it provides decorative function, and it provides light, but it doesn't provide any visibility. Another way he says it is just a fascinating suggestion. He says maybe that the windows were actually at an angle through the wall, if you can imagine. So they went they pierced the wall at a diagonal angle, against the way Chazal is saying it. So therefore, the light would only be actually entering from this particular angle, diminishing the amount of light. Therefore, actually, making the same point the Gemara was making, which is that the point of these windows was not so much about needing light. This is perhaps more decorative function, or perhaps light at a certain time of day, but it wasn't necessarily for the major function of letting light in. Now, what?
Making them white on the outside is the opposite of what one would do for protection.
Right.
Interesting.
Maybe it didn't need protection.
Interesting. That is interesting. Yes. So whenever you go to battlements,
right,
and you visit a castle, that's a very interesting point. Whenever you visit you're visiting a castle, you visit even the old city walls, right? Mm-hmm. And look at where the archers would stand, right? The aperture for shooting, that would be the very smallest area. And the widest area would be on the inside, so you have space to get into that cranny, so the enemy could only have access to a very small area. Interesting. So that would be almost an indication of the opposite of needing that protection. This is not a fortification. This is, in a certain sense, a spreading. That's a very interesting way of looking at the same idea. What my question, and I want to leave this again, I'm just leaving a few questions out today, is my question is the following. Is where is the parallel to that at the Mishkan? In the Mishkan, there were no windows, were they? They were just beams, right? So these golden beams, silver sockets, the whole way through. We didn't have any openings. Where was Shlomo Dramatic drawing this from? What element of the Mishkan beforehand was this derived from? That's a question I'd like to consider.
How was it like in the Mishkan?
Yeah, so actually in the Mishkan it was very dark, with one exception, which was
the menorah.
The menorah. The menorah was essentially the illumination of the Kodesh, and in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, none whatsoever. That was the Holy of Holies, the inner sanctum, completely devoid of light. There was no electricity. If, by the way, I always wonder this, you know, if the Beis HaMikdash is going to be built, like the Rambam says, through human hands, so who's going to get the electricity contract? You know, like, will it be underfloor, under tile heating? Will there be air conditioning? We have to think, you know, if that's going to be the model of the Beis HaMikdash, the Beis Shlish, if we go in the direction of the Rambam.
The Eish coming down on them as well.
What was that? So the Eish, but that's outside. Remember, the Eish coming down the Mizbech is the external Mizbech, which is not inside the building. So are these windows simply decorative, or are they functional as well? And it seems to be the debate that's been had over here. The Rabbi says, no, these seem to be functional if it's the way it's being described as well. If you want to make the point that they're only decorative, then it would be the other way around. This is one element to focus on. One last element I want to just put out there is the idea of these stones. What was interesting is it says that the stones used for the Beis HaMikdash were these beautiful shlemos, these full, wholesome stones. They weren't chipped, they weren't deformed in any way, and you would never hear the sound of the garizen of any metal instrument in the precinct of the Beis HaMikdash. So wait a second. So how did that work then, right? So if you didn't hear the sound, then what was happening? So, interesting enough, this takes us back to an original mitzvah, which is most people don't focus on. At the very, very end of Parashas Yisro, the Torah tells us an interesting mitzvah, and that is in Perik Bay Chof in Sefer Shmos, this is source 20. It says, V'im mizbeach avonim ta'aseli, lo'y sivne esen gozis, ki charbucho heinafto aleho bata chalaleho. We know that when the mizbeach, the altar is built, it cannot be built with a sword, with any metal implement. Why? What's the logic? So the logic is, the Chazal says, it's actually a Mishnah in Midos, which I'm not going to, we're not going to learn right now, just for the interest of time, but if you're interested in looking at it, the Mishnah is in Midos at the top of page 10, where the Mishnah says, and Rashi quotes this in the Torah, that a barzel, metal, is an implement which is mekatzer yomov shel adam, which has the potential, and as humans have exploited it throughout history, has been that which shortens life, and the mizbeach is something which provides life. And you can't bring something which is a destructive force onto a constructive spiritual force. The two don't mesh. This has to be pure, this has to be without sharp implementation. It's fascinating that almost everything that humanity has created, any advance in technology, has always been weaponized. It's fascinating. You know, when air balloons were being floated in France and England, they were trying to marshal air travel at the very beginning. There was a philosopher at the time says, I doubt that it'll be too long before these will be used for the military. And he was right. The French military was actually employing people to be able to see if this is a way they could use in a war against England. Of course, air balloons are not very good because you depend on the wind. So it's very it did not turn out to be a successful endeavor. But the comment is something which we should think about what humans use for destruction. And that being the case, we do not put a destructive force onto the most purest form of life, a life force, which is our place, where we ultimately come close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's interesting, because on the Mizbeach is a place that we burn the slaughtered animals. So just worthwhile thinking about that as the life provider at the same time, as there is an element of, there's a renewal of human life at the sacrifice of animal life, which is one of the ideas of the Mizbeach, is that a human being is meant to think of themselves as being slaughtered, so to speak, see that, and viscerally experience that and think, wait a second, I deserve that. Maybe I need to do things to improve my life based on what just happened, right? So there's that, so to speak, vicariously gives life to the human being. Very interesting just to think about this broadly. Now, let me ask you a question. What is this mitzvah referring to? Where is there a limitation of using a sharp implement in the Beis HaMikdash? Specifically? On the Mizbeach, in the creation of Mizbeach. That pasuk did not say anything else. It didn't say anywhere else that there is a limitation of using garzen, of using or barzel. So this actually now provides a interesting discussion in the Gemara itself. The Gemara talks about this in the following context. Let's take a look at this Gemara just briefly together. This is in source 22, the Gemara in Tamid. The Gemara is describing the daily operations of the temple and what happens in the morning first and next, sequentially every step of the day. So the Gemara tells us, Mukaf Rovdim, there was a chamber which was surrounded by a row of stones. Shel Evan Rovdim Manihu, what does this mean? Gezerosa de Itztaba, de Salki Buhuli Itztaba. So we're talking about chiseled stones where the priests would ascend. They would use these as either steps or places to lie down. Umi Havi Miflagi Avonim. Wait a second. So, but the Gemara asks, How could they split the stones necessary for this, these protruding stones in this chamber? Vaksiv, the Pasuk says, quoting the Pasuk in Melachim, which we just learned, Vabayis vibonosoi even shlema. It was built of complete stones, not hewn stones. The Gemara answers going to the next Hebrew section. Amar Abaya, demisakni umaisi meikora avnei zutrasa v'avnei ravravasa kedichsiv avnei eser amos avnei shmoina amos. So why? He says that, no, there was small stones and large stones, which means, as understood by the Mepharshim, that really they brought these large stones and they hewed them into smaller stones outside the precinct of the temple itself. So let's just think about what the Gemara is trying to tell us. The Gemara seems to be indicating that yes, it is true that the Mizbeach could never be hewn. That it takes naturally occurring stones. But outside the Mizbeach itself, any place in the Beis Hamikdash, you couldn't cut stones there. Where could you cut them? Outside. So yes, of course they had to cut these stones. I mean, if you look at even the remains, you go on the Kotel, on the tunnel tours, and you see the outer perimeter fence, which is not the Beis Hamikdash itself, it's actually just the box which supports the fill-in of the mountain so we could build the Beis Hamikdash on top of it. That's what the Western Wall is. But unless those are hewn stones, right? Metal instruments were used to create those. How did that work? The answer is, well, yes, any of the work that was done on the stones of the Beis Hamikdash was down outside of the precinct of the temple itself. This is the one opinion, which means that's why. What does the Pasuk describe that we just learned in Melachim? What was the limitation? It wasn't that they weren't hewn. It was that you never heard. You never heard the implements. You never heard the chiseling. You never heard the clinking of the metal on the stone in the Beis Hamikdash because it was never done there. It's almost as if this is an echo of what was happening on Mizbeach. Mizbeach never used hewn stone. That wherever. It was never hewn. It was always naturally occurring. But the Beis Hamikdash itself is an echo of that, never had it in the precinct. It is interesting that there is another opinion. There is another opinion which is mentioned in the Mepharshim on this Gemara. We're not going to look at it right now, but there is an opinion that no stone of the Beis Hamikdash was hewn. And then they mention this interesting implement, which we'll spend a little more time on next time, called the Shamir, which is this fascinating, mysterious worm of sorts that was used for at least the first Beis Hamikdash, because they didn't want to even use it on the rest of the stones of the Beis Hamikdash itself, almost expanding the idea of the Mizbeach outwards as well, miraculously to that. Is there a Shamir? Fascinating. Somebody just sent me a very fascinating research about. They have found a worm which actually does eat stones. I'll try to bring in some of the evidence to go there next time, very interestingly enough, which has been found. Whether that is or not is not relevant to us as to what happened then, but it is very interesting. One last interesting halacha which actually appears from this, and that is that there is a halacha that one should not have the knife that one uses for one's bread on the table when one benches. Interestingly enough, why not? So one should either cover it or remove it from the table. Interesting halacha. The Shulchan Aruch cites this halacha. Why not? One explanation is that there was a person who was reading the benching and got to the section of Avnei Yerushalayim and was so distraught over the destruction of Yerushalayim that that person impaled themselves. So in order to so to speak, avoid such circumstances, the knife is symbolically removed from the table. But there's another explanation which is given, and that is that the table is reflective of the Mizbeach, which is why we shouldn't just be sitting on tables, right, in generally. And therefore, if the Mizbeach, when it's being consecrated by our benching, we're benching and we're elevating this experience, we're not just animals, we're elevating this as a spiritual experience, at that moment it's most Mizbeach-esque, and we know there should not be iron, there should not be swords, there should not be implements of destruction, even if it is a household utensil of a sharp knife used for cutting the bread on the table at that time, which is fascinating, a reflection of this halacha which occurs in our daily lives. So let's hold here, because there's obviously a lot more to discuss. Just a few questions that are remaining, as I left off. Question is why is the Shlomo HaMelech is seeking out his own? Why is he leaving behind? A few interesting suggestions that came up today. And another question is where is Shlomo HaMelech getting this idea of these windows? Are they decorative, functional? And where was the, so to speak, the initial model of that in the Beis HaMikdash that he's able to do this? And finally, we looked at this last idea over here, which is the Avonim Shlemos. As we go through, we're going to see very many different and fascinating perspectives of the Beis HaMikdash. Thank you so much for taking the time. Have a wonderful night.